Good morning. Okay, this morning is sponsored by Avraham and Sharon Blumenthal in memory of Avraham's father, Bernard Blumenthal, Baruch ben Yosef, Alav Hashem, and Neshama, have an aliyah. Our learning this morning is in his memory. May his memory continue to be a blessing. This morning we are at the bottom of Chet Amud Aleph. My hope is to make it basically to the top three lines of Tet Amud Aleph, so that next week, please God, we'll be up to the beginning of a daf on Tet, and then we'll finish Tet, which is hopefully, last week took a lot longer than I expected to unpack that one Mishnah, because I guess there's a lot of fundamental principles at play that we were trying to unpack. So what we are at the moment, we're on Chet Amud Aleph, at the bottom green section. The first one on the line is Midi, and then Hazorek Keta Evin from the grey, and we're going to go from there till the bottom of the next Amud. So again, this is content on the third Mishnah of the second Perek, which we've said is essentially a contention that we as citizens have an obligation to pay attention. The first Perek, again, was that we do our best to adjudicate justice. It's never perfect. The second Perek is to contribute to as much perfection in the state of our union as possible, we have to pay attention to those around us. And that means being on guard, not just not to do horrific things intentionally, but to ensure that we don't, through negligence or lack of attention, cause harm to others. And put a different way, what we are outlining, Mishnah by Mishnah, for the first five Mishnahites of this Perek is exceptions to that rule. When is something beyond the purview of my responsibility, how do I carve out the borders of negligence? So the first Mishnah said, if you're doing something in an upward direction and something catastrophic happens, you're absolved. So we said last week it was the kind of Les Mis look down. So if it's going up, you don't have to worry about it. So that's one border of lack of intention. If I'm climbing up a ladder and something happens, or if I'm pushing a roller up a roof and something happens, or I'm lifting up a barrel through rope and something happens, I'm not responsible for that. I don't have to go to Gullus. That's called accidental, which I clarified with my daughter about what accidents are. The second Mishnah we said is if something is indirect, that's another border of your lack of intention. If I throw something and something else throws because of that, I throw something into a tree and a date falls onto a branch and a branch at someone, even at the first level, I take an axe and I smash it into a log and a splinter flies off and kills someone. That's not negligence, that's accidental. You don't have to worry about unintended consequences. There were two views in the Mishnah, that was the prevailing view in the end. So that's another border. We came to the Mishnah on the top of Chet here. The first case now suggests another exception to the issue of negligence is if there's an intruder. And this is where it got complicated last week, because it seems to me this is not about a different mental attitude. In terms of paying attention to unintended consequences, you could say, I didn't consider that. But if we're saying there's somebody in your backyard who was not meant to be there and they died because of you, it could have been somebody who was allowed to be there and it just happened to be your luck it was someone who was an intruder, so you're not responsible. So it sounds like we said last week, there's a kind of social dimension to this law, that you make a commitment to shared citizens, people who are permitted to be in your space, to look out for them. If you're not a citizen, I don't have to pay equal attention to you. If you don't have permission to be in my backyard, I don't have a pre-existing commitment to you. So even if it is absolute negligence, it is shogeg, and I would go to Gullus if it was anybody else, I don't go to Gullus because of that, because you weren't meant to be here. That was the first half of the Mishnah. And then the detail, if you threw something and then somebody poked their head out, you don't have to be unawares all the time that anything could happen. All you have to do is be perfectly aware of your current circumstance. So that was the fourth, boundary. And then the fifth, which is where we turn our attention to the bottom here. So again, so far, if something happens in an upward direction, you're absolved. If something happens indirectly, you're absolved. If something happens to an intruder, you're absolved. And we're going to suggest that intruder is not just in your personal property. We'll get to what if they're a national intruder. They're illegally in the country. By American law, if you harm an illegal, somebody who's in the country legally, I don't think you're absolved from harm, right? I was trying to think, are there any examples of responsibilities we as citizens have to fellow Americans that we're not liable for if somebody's in the country illegally? I don't think there is, right? Because I think American law is if you're in the jurisdiction, any human being, you're liable for harm. We'll have to find an expert. I'm sure there's some difference. Maybe it comes to
employment law,
tax law. Right, when it gets to civil law rather than criminal law, maybe there are differences. So here we've said, we'll get to that in the next Mishnah. If somebody is not meant to be in the country, it's not a citizen, not a resident alien, there's no legal standing, maybe that you don't have responsibility to them either.
The converse, though, is weird that you have diplomatic immunity. Think about that. You have a lot of people in this country who can do whatever they want and will not be liable for it.
Unless they lose their diplomatic position, right.
So long as they have diplomatic immunity, they can shoot you. And
it is astonishing, yeah. I think this was it a few years ago, the Turkish delegation had their bodyguards basically pulverize a bunch of protesters, and they just couldn't be criminally indicted for that because they got diplomatic. I mean, that's what's just happened. His name SBM? Is that what he goes by?
Mm-hmm. There was also a person who raped a woman here or something like that.
In the hotel?
Recently, in the last year.
I wasn't familiar with that case.
So what does that mean to this? I mean, that's...
So this is the question. Is there diplomatic immunity in Jewish law? In Sanhedrin, there's a discussion about whether you can take the king to court. It's a good question.
Diplomatic immunity, my understanding is it's a social construct that we share with other countries. So that's something that we said, listen, while you guys are on our turf, you're not going to touch them. And while we're on your turf, you're not going to touch us. So it seems to be an exchange of...
Oh, yeah, it's a pragmatic. It's not like a...
But the point is, from a construct in terms of morally, I mean, think about what we're doing there. We're allowing someone to be totally...
absolved.
Yeah.
I mean, you could ask the same question. The Justice Department, we've all discovered a lot of rules about the Justice Department over the last 6 years as boundaries have been tested and there's public awareness. There's a Justice Department rule not to indict a sitting president, which makes it sound like if you're a sitting president, you can do anything as long as you stay in office or die in office or manage to avoid, you can't be prosecuted.
It's good to be king.
Well, thank you, Mel. So let us, that was exception number three, intruders you're not responsible for, and number four, which we're getting to. Number four, peripherally, was if you throw something and then somebody puts their head out, you don't have to be liable for things that weren't there at the time. But number five, which is our point now, is if you're doing a duty. So I guess this would be similar to diplomatic immunity. So yes, John, that's a good segue. I mean, if I'm doing something that is my responsibility, but through my negligence, I've got the very same lack of attention. The example is going to be which we discussed last week. If somebody is disciplining a student or a child, and as a result of your discipline, we're going to go off piste. Anyone familiar with Rowan Atkinson?
Yeah.
Mr. Bean? So there's a number of skits that he does you can find on YouTube. There's one skit of him being a principal calling a father into the office and say, you know, I've got to talk to you about your son. While I was administering some discipline, he died. And the father was very sad, and the principal was like, you're missing the point. He was very naughty. And spent the whole time talking about that. And he said, I've cancelled the assembly for the school so that we can all attend the funeral. And the father's like in shock, and he says, don't worry, I've been pulling your leg, I've been joking. They go, oh, and he's like, I wouldn't cancel assembly for that. Anyway, you could watch that. So that's how it used to be in Britain. So if you've got the same negligence. You're striking a student in the ancient world where that was seen as dutiful discipline for the sake of their benefit long term. And accidentally you hit them and they stumbled and they fell and they died. And you say, that was not my intention. So it's not like you were hitting them so hard that that's close to criminal. You smashed them. But you hit them and then something happened that was not accidental, but it was negligent. The Mishnah seems to say you don't go to Gullus for that because that was a mitzvah. The other example of the Shlich based in. If you're administering Malkus to somebody and then something happens and they die and it's negligent, you don't have to go to Gullus because you're in the midst of a duty. That's what we're up to. And I guess the question at that point is, why? Is it that when you're doing a duty, that overrides negligence, and we say, we don't want you to pay attention to possible consequences because you're in the midst of doing something important. We don't want you to lose focus on what you're doing. I actually thought about mentioning it last week, and since we don't have too much text that I'm aiming for today, I'll mention my father, when he was in graduate school, he was in Chicago, and he worked in, it's called the Sonia Shankman Orthogenic School. It's for, still functioning today, it's for children with extreme behavioral disabilities. They didn't have medications that they do today, and these were children who couldn't really socially make it in other circumstances. Parents couldn't handle them, and they went to this school run by Bruno Bettelheim. Bruno Bettelheim, his name I may have mentioned in the past, was a psychoanalyst. He's a survivor of the camps. He wrote a book about the kibbutz movement, and one of the theories he had as he was going through the camps, one of the ways he said that he managed to survive was by essentially becoming a scientist. And there were a few. Viktor Frankl had a similar methodology as to just, how do you survive? I'm going to pretend I'm out of body and I'm observing this. You know, this is not an experiment anyone would ever want to carry out, but I'm in it, so I'll see what I can learn about the human condition. And Bettelheim observed, like many others, that the Nazis weren't just physically persecuting Jews, they were also mentally stripping away their sense of humanity. They took away their names, their clothes, they stamped them with numbers, they took away their hair, their dignity in every way. And he took the sense that if you can strip away someone's personality and humanity, maybe there are environments in which you can build up personality. So he started this school for kids with personality disorders and said, maybe I can foster it and design it and build it in a way where, you know, if you can strip away a name, maybe there's a way to impress upon somebody a name and a personality. So this is a school my father went to help work at. He was, apparently it was easier in those days. He was finishing up undergrad, didn't know what to do with his life, and he read one of Bettelheim's books. And he thought, oh, okay, he was in England at the time. He said, I'll write him a note and say, can I come and work at your school? And apparently he wrote back and said, sure. So off he went to Chicago. And went to work in the school. And he said there was a couple of memories from there that sat with him. And one of them was, which came back to haunt the school, was that they would hit the children as part of their disciplining program. And it wasn't like an abusive institution where you had out-of-control guidance. This was part of the formal discipline measures, that if you want them to be good children and they have to learn, you should hit them. And this was informed by Freudian thought, to some degree, that you needed discipline, you needed a father figure. And my father was a graduate student, and there was a girl who was misbehaving. And the dean of the school at the time, who was female, said to my father, you need to hit her. And my dad said, why don't you hit her? You know, I'm not. And she said, she needs a male figure to hit her at this point. So it was like a psychological thing. Like, I'm not saying she's a terrible person. She needs this kind of medicine psychologically now, and she needs a father figure replacement. You're a man, you should do it. And my father was very ambivalent about it, but, you know, this is his boss, she's the PhD. So he said, he did it, and he turned around and looked at her and said, that really hurt, it hurt his hand. And she said to him, if you would have meant it, it wouldn't have hurt you. And he said, oh, that's weird. And he said the whole thing was just bad. So that's a side point story. But in theory, maybe that's what we're saying, that we don't want you, when you're administering a duty, whether as a court appointee, as a teacher, as a parent, to start second-guessing yourself, I don't want to do anything, because then you miss the point of the discipline. The discipline is meant to be a firm figure saying this is inappropriate, whether it's an appointee of the court or a leader of the family or a leader of a classroom. So maybe that's what it is. We don't want you to worry about negligence. We assume your duty means that you weren't negligent. This was more accidental because you were paying attention. But either way, green section on the bottom of the page. Hazarikta even v'chule. The whole premise that we said this exclusion exists if you're in the midst of a duty is the case given by the Gemara. What's the classic case, the fairy tale case of Shogeg? You're walking in the forest, you've got your axe, and you start chopping away. That's the case, and it says, and if it accidentally something happens, you go to Golis. So on the basis of that example, paradigm, in the forest, the Mishnah says, well, when do you ever have to chop wood? Never. You never have to chop wood. So it must be that you only go to Golis if you're in the midst of a voluntary activity. If you're doing a mitzvah, it doesn't count. So this is where we pick up. Amaleihum Rabban la Rava. The rabbi said to Rava, Mimai de Mechatavid Eitzim Dereshus. Why do you assume that paradigm is a voluntary case? First word in the line is Mimai. It's about 10 lines up in the green. Why do you assume that chopping wood is always voluntary? Surely there are cases when you have an obligation to cut wood. Dilma Mechatavid Eitzim de Sukkah, Mechatavid Eitzim de Maracha. Maybe you're chopping wood for the wood pile in the temple, or you're chopping wood for your sukkah. That's a mitzvah. And even if you're doing a duty, the paradigm now includes dutiful cases. So that falls away. So you can't tell me your father's excluded or based in Shalich is excluded. Amalei Rava's response, given the matzachatov, since if you were to go to the forest to chop wood for your sukkah and you found a pile of wood on the floor, you would say, woohoo, that saved me half an hour and the possibility of going to exile. Love mitzvah, hashanami love mitzvah. So it's not an obligation unless it's a necessity, is Rava's view here. And is it ever a necessity to chop wood? No. If you were to find wood on the floor, that would absolve you from having to do it. So it's never a mitzvah. And this is a very narrow definition of a mitzvah. Because it means if I'm chopping wood for the sake of a sukkah because there wasn't any wood on the floor, I'm not doing a mitzvah. I'm doing a regrettable concession to the fact that I didn't find any wood. It's only a mitzvah if I have to do this act, which we'll get to on the next Amud. There will be a case where you have to harvest something. Even if you would have found pre-harvested material, you would have to do the harvest yourself. We'll see that next page. Eight Lavina Ravara, Larava. So Ravina chimes in and says, hold on a minute. You're telling me that if it's not a necessity, it can never, ever be a mitzvah. And chopping wood's never a necessity because you could find it there. So hold on a minute. Yatsav market. But no, we said that if a father striking a child, Varoed a Talmid of Shlich Beis Din, or if a teacher or a court appointee is disciplining, they're exempt. Lema kevin de ilukamer love mitzvah, hashanam love mitzvah. Surely that's not a necessity. It's not a mitzvah for the shlich beis din to go around beating people, and it's not a mitzvah for the father to beat his child every day. It's only a mitzvah if he misbehaves. So this is where the discipline issue arises. Hatam afal gav de gamer mitzvah. No, that's not true. There is an obligation on a parent or a teacher to administer discipline, even if the child is well behaved. Just make them feel good, or make you feel good. It'll keep them on the straight and narrow. Dechtiv, as it says, Yaseh bin chaviyanichecha, and this is taken from Mishlei, where it says, chastise your child and be calmed, v'yiten ma'adanim nafshecha, and it will bring pleasantness to your soul. Meaning long-term chastisement is a positive thing. Again, parenthetically, we said last week, I would be hard-pressed, I imagine, to find any contemporary rabbinic leading figure to say that this is currently the practice. This is halachically bottom line, and the parents, you know, putting aside whether the social services would come, but if they wouldn't, you should strike your child regularly to keep them on the straight and narrow. In fact, there are many stories, I'm sure, we've heard about great rabbis and their disciplinary practices and how gentle they were while trying to be stern at the same time. Maybe you've heard other stories. Those are the ones I remember hearing. But the sense is here, the transferable value is that fear is a positive dynamic between authority figures and those under their care, which we noted last time. You know, the most productive teachers I have were the ones we were scared of, not that they would hit us, but they just had an aura of, I'm not interested in being your friend. You know, I'll be friendly, but you're always on edge. I remember one of these teachers who was friendly, and I would like make a joke, and they would say like, shut up, Dov. And I'd be like, oh, sorry. And he'd just be like, readdress that boundary every so often so that you feel a little on edge. Hada Amar Rava. And then Rava responded and said, hold on a minute. I feel like I was a bit extreme there, saying cutting wood is never ever a mitzvah. He says, look, it's possible if you're cutting wood for your sukkah, you can see it as a mitzvah. And still, our case, the father would be exempt and the shlich beis din would be exempt from it. So I love Milta Hida Amri. Maybe it's not the way I said it, says Rava. Because what's the paradigm? When you go into the forest, it's not just that forestry is voluntary, but the pasuk says, va'asher. And why do you translate the word asher? And when, or, and if. It could be either. Right, and he's saying, and should you, or if you go into the forest. So, my yardi by ILV by Lyle. So it's talking about a case where you're choosing to go. And if it's talking about a case of mitzvah, it's not a voluntary activity. So he kind of steps back from the edge of saying that it's only a mitzvah if it's a necessity, and says maybe it's a mitzvah even if it's not a necessity. But the pasuk's describing a case which is voluntary, so anything that is a duty, a mitzvah, something b'shogeg happens, you're exempt. Okay. We've got a parenthetical remark about this observation about the word asher, and when I ask you what it means, someone's going to turn around and say, hold on a minute, anytime it says, and should you, that means, it's only voluntary. We've got a case where the verse says, if you are tamei and you walk into the Bet Mikdash, you are chayv kares, which is bad news. Ish, and how do we know? Because the verse says, v'ish asher yitma v'lo yitchata, if somebody becomes impure and doesn't cleanse themselves, and they go into the Bet Mikdash, they're chayv kares. But it said the word asher, ish asher yitma. Should a person become tamei? And if you're suggesting asher always means voluntary, so you're talking about if somebody went to visit somebody who was passing away, and they were there, and they happened to get tamei. But, it says asher. Does that mean only if it was voluntary? Meet mitzvah. Let's say you're walking along the road. You're going to the Bet Mikdash to bring a korban, and there's, unfortunately, somebody passes away. There's nobody to help. You're the only one there. That's a case of a meet mitzvah. This is not voluntary. I have to become tamei now. So maybe I can go to the Bet Mikdash. It said, asher, and if you become tamei. But if I had to become tamei, maybe I wouldn't be chayv kares and I could go. Meet mitzvah, delo sagi, delo mitma, hachinami pater. Maybe I should be exempt and I could go to the Bet Mikdash. Shani hatam, it's different there, dam akra, as the verse says. Tamei yiyeh. The verse continues. If you look bottom right hand side at the, on this page, they've got the Torah Or HaShalem. That's where you've got the psukim. So this is Chet Amud Bet now, the bottom right Torah HaShalem. This is the full psukim where it's quoted. So this part is Kol Anogeh B'Meit B'Nevesh Ha'Adam Asher Yamud V'Lo Yitchate Et HaMishkan Hashem Timei V'Nichvut HaNevesh Imi Yisrael Ki Minet Elo Nisrak Alav Tamei Yiyah Otum HaTabo. So a couple of extra words there at the end that don't seem to add anything particular. So here Rava says Tamei Yiyah. It says Tamei Yiyah at the end Mikol Makom. It means even if you had to become Tamei, you would get Kares if you go into the Bet Mikdash. Mikol Makom. Top of the line. Ha'um Mibaylei. So his interlocutor Rav Ada responds and says, "No, tamei yiyeh l'chedetanya, tamei yiyeh l'rabat tful yom." That includes a different kind of tumah, tumah tabo l'rabat mechus kippurim. Talking about different phases of tumah that you're still chayv kares, even if you're on the way to becoming pure. Amalei ana miod ka'aminan. Rava says, "Well, it says the word od. What you can do with that, huh? Od comes to tell you that even if voluntary, even if by necessity you became tamei, you become chayv kares. Full stop." End of that parenthetical discussion. We're now into the yellow. And the yellow is a re-presentation of how Rava made his statement about duties and mitzvot, which touches on our Mishnah. Again, the basic point in the Mishnah is, if you're fulfilling a duty, you are exempt from going to Galus. You're not responsible for negligence. We're going to question whether that would include a father striking a child, and we'll come back to resolve that. But this is a standalone piece, in a sense. Ika de matni la'aha. There are some people who teach it as follows. First word on the line, b'charish, and this is going to be helpful again. That little bet with the bracket tells you to look down at the pasuk. So if everybody looks down to that pasuk, it's the first wide line of the psukim in the middle. Sheshet yamim ta'avod. 6 days you shall work. V'yom ha'shvi tishbot. You shall rest on the seventh. B'charish v'katsiv tishbot. From plowing and harvesting you should rest. What's the context of that pasuk where it says 6 days work, 7 day rest? What are we talking about?
Shabbos.
Yeah, it's talking about Shabbos. What else could it be talking about? It says work for six, rest on seven. But then it adds, and you shouldn't harvest and you shouldn't plow either. So it sounds like what we know that you can't do that on Shabbos. It just said rest. Why is it telling me specifically don't do these two things? That's the question. So, first word on the line in the yellow, b'charish v'katsir tishbot. It says, from plowing and harvesting you should rest. Rabbi Kiva, Omer, Rabbi Kiva says, ein tzarech le'mecharish shel shviyis, v'katsir shel shviyis. It has to be talking about Shemitah, these extra words. Because we know you can't do this on Shabbos. Why does it add these two in particular? The agricultural content makes it sound like it's talking about Shemitah. But charish shel shviyis, v'katsir shel shviyis, we already know you can't plow and harvest during Shemitah. Sharik farnema, sad chalotit rove, kamalat tizmar. We already know you can't do those things on Shemitah. Ella afilu, so what does this add? So for Rabbi Akiva, this is very strange. It's talking about Shabbos. work 6 days and rest on the seventh. And then it adds three words to tell you that on Shemitah, you can't do the following. Afilu charish al erev shviyas. You can't plow on erev shviyas, shenichnas shviyas, right on the way in. And you can't harvest on Shviyas, just on the way out. So there are extra measures right before and after Shemitah as well. Full stop. Rabbi Yishmael disagrees. By the way, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yishmael are kind of arch enemies when it comes to exegetical practices. There are whole volumes dedicated to the different schools of Midrash, where Rabbi Kiva is puts a huge amount of emphasis on every letter, every word, in ways that don't always track with the pshat, so to speak. And Rabbi Yishmael is a more pshat-oriented commentator, and they've got different midrashic traditions as well. So, Bishmil Omer, he says, he's talking about Shabbos. Ma Charish, are you ever allowed to harvest on Shabbos? Any times you can imagine where it might be not Pekoach Nefesh, where you'd be allowed to go into the field and start cutting wheat? That's it. That's the only one. For Kitzirat HaOmer, if you're harvesting the Omer, what's the Omer again? It's a korban. We don't bring it anymore, but this would be, you have to harvest barley grain, for the Omer Korban. When do you have to harvest it? It has to be done the night before. That's the only time. And it has to be bought on second day Pesach. So if the first day of Pesach is a Shabbos, has to be done the night before, you have to start harvesting. So this is that one kind of trivia question. When am I allowed to harvest on Shabbos and on Yom Tov? It's going to be the first day Pesach to make the Tziras HaOmer. And for Rabbi Yishmael, we know that from this Pasuk that you're permitted to. You might have thought maybe this is an exception for the Tziras HaOmer and you should harvest before Shabbos. He disagrees. Ma'charish Rishut, Af Katzir Rishut. On Shabbos, just as plowing is always voluntary. Is there ever a mitzvah to plow? Is there any circumstance where you have to plow? But if you had come to a field and you found it already plowed, you wouldn't have to plow. No, there's no mitzvah to plow ever. So just as charish, just as plowing is always rishut, af ketzir rishut, so only voluntary harvesting is prohibited on Shabbos. Yatzik ketzir ha-omer shu mitzvah. So you're allowed to harvest for the omer on Shabbos. Amalehu rabban l'rava. And the rabbis respond to him, say, hold on a minute, how do you know plowing's rishus? Maybe there are times where it's a mitzvah to plow. When might there be a mitzvah? Charishat omer mitzvah. Maybe, you know, I'm not a farmer. Let's say the current Israeli economy shifts entirely away from agriculture. There are Israeli farmers. Not a huge number now. A lot of food is imported. Tech industry is more important. Let's say it just obliterates farming entirely, makes a deal with the Saudis in the next few months, say, you're going to give all the grain. And we're going to not farm. So what happens if the Bet Mikdash comes back? You need to bring the Omer. So I need to plow. That's a mitzvah. So here maybe you also have to not plow or harvest even dutifully on Shabbos. This is Rava's narrow definition again. If you were to come to a field and it happened to be plowed, you don't have to say, oh, this doesn't count. I need to go to another field and plow. There's no inherent mitzvah or necessity in plowing. It's considered a voluntary activity always. So when it says don't plow and don't harvest, it means voluntarily. But you can do a mitzvah on Shabbos with Ketzira. Eight Ravina Rava. So this is where Ravina jumps in against Rava. Yatzaha Ava Maket Benova Rava Redet Talmid of Shlich Beis Din. We've said in the Mishnah just now that if a father is striking a child, they're exempt because it's a mitzvah. Sounds like maybe Rava, it shouldn't be a mitzvah because it's not a necessity. It's just a concession to a badly behaved child. Amai Lemek Kivin De Gemir Love Mitzvah. Maybe it's not a mitzvah. Ashanami Love Mitzvah. It should never be considered a necessity act. Hatam afagav degamir nami mitzvah ka'avid. No, and it comes back to the point. Even if the child's well behaved, it is always a necessity to chastise a student. Dichtiv yasib min chavinechecha, as we say from that verse. And we're now going to finish the next section in four lines. Hatam arava, rava says, love milti damri. Maybe I went too far in narrowly defining mitzvah as only when it's a necessity. And he's going to reread the verse of saying, even if it is considered a mitzvah to plow when you don't find a plowed field, maybe the pasuk describes in a way where you know Ketzirah HaOmer is exempted on Shabbos. Ketzirah Dumya de Charisha. The only Ketzirah that is prohibited on Shabbos is similar to the Charisha, which is prohibited on Shabbos. Ma Charisha Matzah Charash, just as if you had found a field plowed, Einu Charash, you don't have to plow. Even if you're plowing because there isn't, that might be a mitzvah. If you found a plowed field, nobody says you have to do it. Af Katsira Nami, so too, the only the Katsira that you wouldn't have to do is prohibited. And if you think when it comes to Katsira Ta'omer, I found wheat, I don't have to harvest, mitzvah likso lahavi, you should know it is always a mitzvah. So this is one time you come to a field, there's wheat sitting there, you can't use that for Katsira Ta'omer, you have to actually harvest it for the purposes of bringing the Omer, full stop. So that's the end of Mishnah 3 of the Perek, where we have said there are three more exemptions to negligence. Number one, an intruder. Number two, a introduction of a head into the situation. And number three, like that. And number three, in the midst of a duty. You don't go to Gullus. Negligence is accepted. Full stop. New Mishnah, Mishnah number four. And this may be read in a number of different ways. Ha'av gola al yedei ha-ben. A father has to go to Gullus due to something that happens to a son. Meaning, if a father kills a child by accident, the father goes to Gullus. And that makes sense to everybody? Oh, so we're going to come to that. If a grandfather accidentally kills a grandchild, the father is a Goel Adam. Does he have to kill his own father? Is he allowed to? Is he obligated to? I mean, this is a horrific question. This was in the news last year. They're horrific to imagine. There was a family who went on, I'm sure you saw this, on a cruise. And the grandfather was playing with a grandchild toddler near a railing, and the kid fell out of the boat. And he was taken to court and sued by whatever state's got jurisdiction over the cruise ship for negligence. And he said that it wasn't me, it was the ship, and it was litigation. But can you imagine being the parents who your parents are being sued for the death of your child? It's an impossible psychological dynamic. And that's, we'll get to that in the next stuff. But for now, we're just saying a father does go to Gullus if they kill a child. In a second, the Gemara is going to say, you just told me if he's hitting his son, he doesn't go to Gullus. So we're going to have to find a case where a child is killed by a parent where they would have to go to Gullus. V'haben gola al yedei ha'av. And a child goes to Gullus for the father. So if a child accidentally kills a parent, they have to go to Gullus. And the question, I guess, is, well, why not? I mean, if you kill a parent, there's a possibility you might not have to go to Gullus?
Might be a super requirement of knowing where they are.
Right, you might have an obligation to be attentive that my parent could be anywhere at any time, and if anything happens, that's not negligence, which is a possibility, an astonishing awareness. Then every moment of my day, I have to be conscious that my parent might be here, which means that I can never do anything negligent because my parents might be here. And the only reason that I'm not responsible for having to somebody else is because I don't owe them the same level of awareness. So this is where the social contract, but what it seems to be is that's not true. You don't have to be hyper attentive to your parent. You're the same attentive as everybody else. You go to Gullus if you kill a parent. Hakol, that's the first part of the mission. The second part, Hakol Golan Ali De Yisrael. Again, imagine the American metaphor. You say, everybody goes to exile because of Americans. So everybody goes to Gullus in Israel because of Israelites. Well, who else is in Israel apart from Israelites?
Levites.
So they're part of the Israelite. They're an Israeli citizen. So are they in the ideal state? Well, I mean, they're Israeli citizens, right? Jews and Arabs. So in a halachic state, presumably they would have to become halachic citizens at some level. That might involve what we call conversion or commitments. So who else is legally allowed in the country? So it might be people who are legally in the country. But everybody goes to Gullus for something they do to a Jew. The Yisrael go on the day hen, and Jews have to go to Gullus for something they do to them. Chutz, with one exception, Miger Toshav. Anyone remember Ger Toshav? The resident alien. So a Ger Toshav is somebody who commits in front of a Bet Din to observe the seven Noahide laws. And they're allowed, and the reason they call it a Ger Toshav, a resident, is they're permitted to live in a halachic state. This is the equivalent of what we call in America a green card holder. What is that? A permanent resident. Meaning I commit to certain American laws and I'm allowed to live here. But there are things I'm not allowed to do as a permanent resident. There's actually only one thing I'm not really allowed to do. I can't vote in federal elections.
Can't become president.
But that's even if I'm a citizen now, I can't become president. And I'm a citizen now, I can't run for president.
No.
No, you have to be a natural-born American citizen.
Except for Obama.
Let's go down that road. Although it's true that... No, sorry, let me start again. It is complicated because... why was it complicated during the 2008 election? Obama and McCain, there were people who claimed neither of them should be able to run for president. People said Obama wasn't born in America. And we happen to know that McCain definitely was not born in America. Where was McCain born?
Army base.
I think it was in Panama, right? It was on an American army base. So that there was a debate whether
that's
so is it American territory? That was a debate. Then in 2016, there was a question about the people who were running. Who ran in 2016 and people said shouldn't legally be allowed to run? So they were the final candidates, but among the nominees, Ted Cruz. Trump said Cruz shouldn't be able to run because where was Cruz born?
Canada.
On an army base? No, he was just born in Canada. But his claim was, but I was a natural born American because when I was born, I was an American citizen because my parents were Americans. That has never been tested in the American courts, but there have been many people who have run for office who were born American citizens, not in America. But Trump said, you know, during one of the debates, this should go before the court, because if he becomes our nominee and then they take it to court and they say you're not a natural-born American, we don't have a nominee. That was after he said that his father killed JFK. So I don't know at that point how seriously people were taking his claims. But that's something that sticks. What is something as a permanent resident that disappears that you can't vote? I can now vote, but I couldn't vote when I was a resident alien. So Ger Toshev has limits and less obligations. They don't have to keep Shabbos in the same way. They don't have to keep kashrus. In fact, if you have a non-kosher animal, there's a mitzvah to give it to the permanent resident, give it to the Ger Toshav to eat. So that's a Ger Toshav. And we said if a Yisrael kills a Ger Toshav, they don't go to Galus, is what it sounds like. So what happens? I'm still not entirely clear on that. And I've tried becoming more clear on that. If you kill a permanent resident, we say you don't go to Galus. Does that mean that their Goalei Adam can come after you? Or does that mean you're just not liable for negligence when it comes to a Ger Toshav? We'll have to get more into that. The Ger Toshav Einu Goalei Ela Al Yidei Ger Toshav. But a Ger Toshav does go to Galus if they kill another Ger Toshav. Meaning as a permanent resident... Oh, and it doesn't work the other way. If a permanent resident kills an Israelite, if a green card holder kills an American, they don't go to Galus either. So what happens to them? Sounds a little scary, but basically execution. When it comes to permanent residence, there are higher standards of negligence. And if you do things that other people would be let off, you might be culpable and sent for execution. So let's see. Ha'av gola al yidei ben. We're dealing with the first half of the Mishnah right now, and then we'll get to the second half later. So, ha'av gola al yidei ben. The Mishnah says, a father goes to Golus if he does something to the child. V'hamart, but you said, yasav ha'maket beno. It excludes a father who smites a child. Degamir, oh, we're talking about if the kid, do you see how much the Gemara is resisting this possibility that you might hit a child who's well-behaved? Three times now the Gemara has said, well, hold on a minute, if you smite a child who's well-behaved, that can't be a mitzvah. And Rava keeps coming back and saying, how many times do I have to tell you? Keep hitting them. V'amar, afagav degamir mitzvah ka'avid. No, we said if you smite a child, it's a mitzvah. Oh, what happens? And how many of you at some point helped a child learn to drive? Sat in a car. How was that for you? All right, it was okay. I used to drive to school with my mother in the car for like the last year of high school. There was a physical impression in the door handle by the end of the year where I'm like, if we crash, that is not going to help you, Mum. Please let go of the door. It's stressing me out. Which didn't calm her down, surprisingly enough. So let's say a father is not teaching Torah, but is teaching a trade to a child and they lose patience and hit the child as part of the discipline and something happens to the child. That's not, you know, is it a mitzvah to teach a child a trade?
Yes,
which is what the command, what are you talking about? Surely the Nagri Chayutehi, if the child's being taught a trade by a parent or being taught how to drive or being taught how to swim, those are obligations on the part of a parent. So you should be exempt if something negligent happens. Oh, delamde degame umnata akriti. So it must be talking about a case where a child is teaching... is being taught a secondary occupation by a parent, meaning they're a carpenter, they can make a living, and the parent says, carpentering is not for you. I want you to be a doctor, I want you to be a lawyer, I'm going to train you in something else. And it's not strictly speaking necessary, but they're doing it anyway, and something happens, you go to Gullus. What would be the simplest case where a father would go to Gullus for a child dying?
It's a regular case.
Yes, fall off a ladder.
Yeah.
So why is the Gemara not going down this route? The commentary suggests, well, that's obvious. Of course, if a father lands on a child. But we're talking about a context where it seems like an obligation, but strictly speaking, it's not necessary. He's teaching them an occupation. So you're involved in teaching, but it's not quite necessary. So what the Gemara has now allowed for is that there are circumstances where you're doing something that's not strictly speaking necessary, and it's not classified as a mitzvah, almost proving the point that if you're chopping wood and you don't need to, it's not a mitzvah. If you're teaching an occupation, you don't need to, it's not a mitzvah. So we're circling around these issues, full stop. V'haben gola alidei ha'av, we said, and a son goes to Gullus for spriting a father, killing a father. Now, if I hit my father, is that permitted or prohibited?
Prohibited?
Well, let's start this way. If I hit anybody unprovoked, is that permitted in Jewish law?
No.
What's the punishment for me hitting somebody else?
Lashes
and I have to pay any harm, which means I only get one punishment for a single act. So if I hit somebody, what do I have to do? I have to pay them damages. Unless I hit them and... Has anyone seen this? It's just started coming up on my Facebook feed, which is horrific. There's this new sport. I don't know what it is. It's like slapping.
Oh, it's amazing.
it's unbelievable. You have people stand there. They just stand next to each other and they just go, whoomp. Right, your turn. Whoomp. And it's like...
They pass out.
Right, like, have they seen the movie Concussion? And they're wearing helmets. It's like they're just smacking each other in the face. What is it called? Slapping. Right. So
Eastern European sport.
That's what it looks like to me. Is it a women's sport only?
No, it's men also.
It's crazy. So, and you can't look away from these things. So there was this, I saw there was these two women who were standing there ready for this, and they looked like they've been preparing. And I felt bad for one of them, because one of them, you know, you stand there and they're going, whoosh. You know, with golf, when you're ready, so they're getting ready. And he went, whoomp, and she just went, didn't move. And then it was her turn and she just like collapsed and fell over. But it could be you hit somebody and you think it's really hard and you don't do any damage. So if I hit somebody and it ends up doesn't do any damage, like it's like 2 cents is, you know, they're going to need a Band-Aid and that's it. So that doesn't amount to civic damages if it's under a pruta. So if I hit them and there's no damages, I do get lashes. So strictly speaking, it's lashes unless there are damages involved. So what happens if I hit my father? What's the punishment? Lashes and damages?
Death.
You hit a parent? Death. So inform the slapping authorities, no parent-child matchup. Because you hit a parent, that's it. Which is why there's a... Right, so there are complications about whether you make them bleed or not. And then there are discussions about what happens if a child is a doctor and a parent needs to be operated on. You cut them, they're going to bleed. Are you allowed to operate? There are discussions, halakhic context about that. And, you know, if you make a mistake, who knows? That's generally a question in the medical profession. But here, this is the premise. If a child strikes a parent and doesn't kill them, they're chayv misa. So if my parent dies because of me, it should be treated differently than if somebody dies because of me and I go to Gullus. You know, what if I hit my father by mistake? Misa? And is Shogeg, I'm exempt? So we'll see. There's an assumption that maybe you might have thought, if you hit B'Shogeg, you go to Gullus. Because if I hit on purpose, it's death. So if I hit accidentally, maybe, I mean, that's insane. I hit my... There's an assumption that any capital crime done negligently leads to Gullus in the interhuman realm. So if I hit my father on purpose, I get executed. So if I hit my father negligently, maybe I have to go to Gullus, which again is an astonishing thing about how much attention you might have to pay to your parent. And we said that's not true. So parents out there, sorry about that. Or feel good. Vaben galidei ha'av, and a child goes to Gullus for the father. Rumini, we've got a contradiction. There is a verse that says only a makeh nefesh, somebody who strikes a soul, goes to Galus, Prat Lamaka Av, and that excludes somebody who hits a father. And there are going to be two answers, because our Mishnah said a son goes to Galus for killing the father accidentally. We've now got a quote from a Braita that says a child does not go to Galus for hitting a father. And there are going to be two answers to how these two can jive at the same time. One says yes, Galus, the other says no, Galus. The first answer is going to be Amar of Kahana. Lo Kasha, Harab Shimon HaRabanan. The Mishnah is talking about the rabbis, which say you go to Galus if you hit a father. But Rab Shimon would agree, you do not go to Galus if you negligently kill a parent. What happens to you instead?
You
go to therapy and watch out for the Goel Adam. You don't get to Galus. You don't get executed, but you don't go to Galus. Rab Shimon. One is Rab Shimon, one is Rabbana. Now, this is a somewhat complicated detail. How many different kinds of capital punishments are there? Close?
Four.
Closer. Four. So you, right, you've, there's a nice song you've got for it? Really? Somebody thought this was a good tune, a good thing to sing? Okay, what was it again? What order did you sing it? So there's a debate in Kiddushin as to which order they should be in, so I assume there are two versions to the song. If you start with the strictest, you've got skila, stoning, srefa. By the way, stoning, there are a lot of details of how these work. Stoning, we usually imagine that you kind of throw stones at. That's not how stoning would work, according to the Gemara. You take somebody to the edge of a cliff, you throw them off, and then you throw a big boulder off the edge. Yeah, it's not a pleasant system. Srefa, again, maybe we imagine the medieval witch burning. Yeah, so it would be internal burning. They would pour hot material inside. Again, we've got no evidence any of this ever took place. This is a description of how theoretically it would be carried out.
Game of Thrones-esque.
That was gold on the head, right? Do they put lead inside in any of them? Oh, right, there you go. So that is a, that's Srefa. Then how's the song?
Hereg.
What's Hereg? Hereg is Saif. Hereg is just decapitation.
Oh.
And the assumption there is it wasn't like a guillotine, you'd have a sword and you'd decapitate, Game of Thrones style. I haven't seen any of that. House of Dragons, yeah, I've got to wait a few years until no one asked me if I've seen it. And the last one is Chenek. Chenek, we imagine, is like a gallows, strangulation. Suffocation. But the Gemara describes it as, there would be a belt put around and you'd pull both sides until the person couldn't breathe. Again, these are not pleasant descriptions, and the Gemara tries to describe how we would make it as painless as possible, which is, I don't know if that's true under American law. When they
Didn't they drug them before or something?
They would get them drunk. They give them a lot of wine so you have no sensations and then do these things. In American law, I think they have to do something to sedate you before they kill you. Is that right? If you die by injection?
Otherwise, it's a rule.
So. They just have to do it quickly.
You don't have to be sedated.
I don't think so.
I think there is...
Electrocution, you just...
Pull the plug.
I think so.
They don't do electrocution anymore, right? The electric chair is not permitted?
I don't think so.
Right. I think they just put back on the books in Michigan that you can get by a firing squad. Right? Which always goes smoothly.
Well, now they just do it by injection, I think.
Well, there were complaints. I think I just saw a headline yesterday. Two-thirds of executions were botched in Tennessee through injections last year, which is like quite a high number of, you know, if a doctor failed two-thirds of the time, you'd say, give me a second opinion.
That's their job. They failed two-thirds. It's their job.
Right. So the claim was bring back the firing squad because that was 100% effective. Nobody like made it afterwards, but you had 18 people shooting at you. I'm not sure it's pleasant. Either way, so the reason I brought this up is there is a debate as to which one is stricter. Is Chenek or Hereg stricter? So according to Rab Shimon, Da'ama Chenek Chamer Misayef, he says strangulation is a worse form of punishment than the sword. Shigigat Chatsayef Nitna Lachapara. So if a crime you would be executed by decapitation for, you can get go to Galus for. And Saif is regular murder. So if I kill somebody, I get executed by decapitation. If I did that negligently, I go to Galus. So by definition, if that's a stricter form of punishment, Shigigat Chenek, lo nit lechapara. Sorry, other way around. If Chenek's stricter, and I hit a parent, I kill a parent, I get chenek, maybe I can't go to galus. Maybe that's a strict punishment. But the rabbis who say hereg is a stricter form. So you could still go to galus. So maybe there's a debate between these two mishnayos as to whether killing a parent you can go to galus. Full stop. Rava's got a different solution and say no. Rava says anytime you kill a parent, you go to galus. But there was a question about what happens if I hit my parent accidentally. Omer pradla alse chabura ba'aviv. So this is what Dror was saying in terms of making bleed. Do they have to bleed outside the body, or if they bruise? So if they bruise, that's considered bleeding as well if you hit a parent. So if you hit a parent and they bruise, you might think b'shogeg, I have to go to galus. If I did this on, you know, on purpose, I go get executed. So maybe I have to go to shagadach amina. Kivin to meiz ba'katala who shogi nami ligle kamash malan. Full stop. So bottom line, first part of that Mishnah is a father and a child is no different to any other citizen. You have an obligation of attention, no more, no less than anybody else. If you kill somebody accidentally, parent, child, anybody else, you go to galus. The extra addition is a parent is liable even in the midst of a non-necessary duty. They're teaching a trade, and you might have thought to excuse that, but you go to galus even in that context, full stop.
Ben, so what's the hava mina of why we need to specify ben gola? You know, why is the pshita? What is it trying to teach us?
You might think that they get executed instead of going to galus, because if they hit them, they get executed. So if they kill them by accident, they get executed too. It says no, also galus. Okay, hakol gol nana didei Yisrael said everybody, if they do something to a Jew, goes to galus and vice versa. And now again, based in mind that who's living in the Jewish state. Jewish citizens. Who else could be there other than Jews? And we said a ger toshav, but we said that's excluded. So we say everybody is involved with galus when it comes to Jewish citizens, apart from a ger toshav. Who else is in Israel?
I'm there on a 30-day visa.
Right. So that's what we're going to come to. There. I mean, in America, who's here apart from Americans and permanent residents? Tourists, illegal aliens, tourists, business visas, all sorts of other people can be here. So what happens... Student visas. So what happens if I do something accidentally to somebody who's here, who's not a citizen, and is not a permanent resident? Are there any liabilities?
Well, I think that it doesn't matter.
Right. So that's, I assume, in American law, you can't kill people just because they're not legally here. And it's not just, obviously, you can kill them. But if I did it by accident, there's no like, oh, don't worry about it. It was an accident.
I mean, there's a law that they can't be slighted or...
Right, and it's probably the, you know, humane law or whatever it's called, because it's saying it's not just citizens we care about. Any human being, you can't do this harm. Okay. Hakol Gonal Yisrael. Hakol Gonal Yisrael, Letuye Mai. First one on Yisrael, it's in the pink. We'll get to the bottom now. What does that include? Letuye Eved Vakuti. It includes an Eved. This is an Eved Kanani. Now, an Eved Kanani, do they have any Jewish connection? Are they considered Jewish citizens in any way?
Yeah.
Do they have obligations in Eved Kanani? Any mitzvahs? They have the... yes, they do. As Jay said, reluctantly, they have the same Jewish obligations as women do. Meaning any mitzvah a woman is obligated in, they have. And any prohibitions women have, they have. And this is one of those, I guess, awkward moments where it sounds like we're comparing the two. Oh, women, slaves are all the same. Like when one of the Rosh Hashiva at YU was asking a woman read a ketubah at the chuppah, and they said, a monkey can read a ketubah. It's like, are you saying women are monkeys? And it was inarticulately put, perhaps, but the Mishnah, the Gemara in Kedushin says, ma'aseh kof ba'alma, meaning reading a ketubah, is anyone could, a monkey could do it. So he was kind of parroting what the Gemara says. And people said, it sounds like you're saying women are like monkeys can do it. So, you know, if monkey can do it, I guess a woman could do it. That's not what he meant. He just meant it doesn't matter who does it. So it's true that women and slaves have the same obligations. The theme is essentially the same. Why women exempt from any mitzvahs? They should have the same obligations as men. Why women exempt from mitzvahs? Because they're time bound. Why should that matter? Why women exempt from time bound mitzvahs?
The
right, the assumption is that they have obligations in the home in the mean that you can't just drop everything. And if a woman is blessed to have children at the age of child rearing, it is impossible to just say, okay, time for shul, time for this. I mean, I'm not a woman, and I'm in the 21st century, and I feel like that because duties are starting to be shared more equally, which means, you know, it's very hard. I've got to drop this to go to shul and drop this to... And at that point, it's like, okay, Miriam, I'm sorry, we're back to the... You're in charge of the house. It's Zman Grama. So Eved Kanani, they can't just drop things. If their master says, you go do this, you go do this. So why do they have any mitzvahs? Why are they Jewish in any way? They're in Eved Kanani. Why should they have mitzvahs? Again, if we assume that Judaism is not just a religious doctrine, it is a political identity. If you're living in the country legally, you're hired by a home, you're bound by Jewish law. You're exempt from time-bound things, but you're exempt as any citizen would be. So this is a case of a non-ger toshav who's living in Israel, who's not Jewish, who if I kill them by accident, I go to galus, and if they kill me by accident, I go to galus. So an eved, now what's a kuti? This is a resident of Israel who was implanted there by an Assyrian king, and we're kind of on the fence about whether they're legal citizens. But they're in Israel, they're practicing Jewish law to some extent, so we suggest if you kill them, you also go to galus. Latuye mai, latuye eved v'kuti. Tanina lahad etan rabbanan, eved v'kuti gola v'lo kalid zeh Yisrael. And we're now going to say, oh, this is just like another Mishnah, that a servant and a kuti, they go to galus and they get lashed for something they do to a Jew. V'Yisrael gola v'lo kalid zeh kuti. And a Jew also goes to galus and gets lashed for something they do to a kuti in an eved. Bishlam eved v'kuti gola zeh Yisrael v'lo kalid. The Gemara says it makes perfect sense that if a eved ivri or a kuti does something to a Jew, there are cases where they get exiled and cases where they get lashes. When would this be? Gola dekatle, they get exiled if they kill. Veloka delatye, and they get lashed. This is a question. When would an eved ever get malchus? There are no obligations in which an eved would get... I mean, when do Jews get malchus? If you break a law in the Torah. Does an eved get lashes for anything? Strictly speaking, they should get lashes of their pig, right? Meaning they're bound by any laws that women are bound by. But what about lashes for doing something to somebody else? When would they ever get lashes for that? Answer, delatye, when they curse them. That is, if you curse somebody, you get malchus. But when you say a Jew goes to galus or gets lashes for something they do to a kuti, bishlam agala dekatle. It makes sense if they kill them, you go to galus, you go to exile, that's killing. Eloka amai, when would a Jew ever get lashes for something they do to an eved? If you kill them, you're executed. If you kill them by accident, you go to galus. When would I ever get lashes for something I do to them? If I injure them, I pay them. When is there ever a case? Yeah, that was my tease. The beginning, that's where we're going to end up. So delatche, it can't be talking about if you curse them, because now this is an interesting aside as to how do we relate to non-residents. It seems to be you are permitted to curse a resident slave or a kuti. V'nasi ba'amecha lo ta'or, because it says, and a prince among your people you shall not curse, but osa ma'asa amecha, that's only people who practice your laws. Meaning if somebody is a regular citizen like you, you are prohibited from cursing them. I don't think it's a good idea to curse other people. We've got certain responsibilities to guard our tongue for our own purposes. But there's no lashes for cursing somebody who's not a full citizen. Oh, maybe it's talking about if a Jew were testifying against a kuti or an eved, and then they turned out to be zomamim, and you couldn't apply it vice versa. What do you get if you can't apply it? Lashes. Gabi Eved, hey, the Chavate, but what about the inverse? It says, just as this, also a non-Jew, and a non, Kuti and Eved can't testify. The Gabi Eved, hey, Baba Huzam, everybody, so it can't be that's what it's talking about. It must be a different case where there is an inverse relationship. Ela Amravaka, Breda of Ika, Hug of My Skin, and we're talking about a case, Kagon Shikawa Ka, over onto Tet, and then we're going to finish these three lines. Shein Bo Shava Prote, it must be if you hit an Eved, and it's less than a Shava Prote, you don't have to pay damages, and you get lashes. And we don't compare cursing to hitting. You are permitted to curse a non-citizen, an eved or a kuti. You are or let's put it this way, you're not liable for cursing them. You are liable if you hit them, and if there are no damages to pay, you get lashed. So, full stop. What we're going to turn to next time is the status of a permanent resident. Why is it that if I kill them by accident, I don't go to Galus? Why is it if they kill me by accident, they don't go to Galus? What is this relationship we have with people who can live in Israel but are non-citizens? We'll flesh that out next week. And then we'll turn to what if somebody blind is chopping wood and somebody dies as a result? Do they go to Galus? Is that a good idea to give a blind person an axe and say, go hack some wood? We'll get to that next week. In the meantime, I wish you all a Chanukah Sameach and a good day. Thank you all. And Leonishmat Bernard Blumenthal.